Morning, everyone. Sorry for the late start. We just had one or two technical issues. It's the strength and weakness of technology. The strength is that we're reaching a lot more people than we used to, not only in Sydney, but beyond, thank God. The weakness is that sometimes things go wrong. We have to wait a few minutes. How are we doing there, Yaakov? Okay, almost ready. Okay, so this is week two of mindfulness and the flow of the mind and heart. And today we're going to be talking about something called building the mind. Now, I just need to spend a few moments reviewing what we did last week. We covered a lot. I want to just sort of summarize a little bit what we did last week so we can move into, it'll flow into what we're doing this week. So we're going through the ideas that mindfulness is not just about the ability to pay attention on purpose, to be present in the moment and to maximize the full potential of the present moment. But we started using the concept of mindfulness to learn how to focus so that we can control our responses. Right? We can control our emotional responses. Most of our responses during the day are emotional. They come from what we feel. As we talked about last week, that we've got stimulus, things that happen, which we most of the time cannot change. But there's how we respond to those things that happen. And we talk about the pause in the middle, that when we engage in or when we apply the principle that the mind could actually rule the heart, that the mind can guide and control and change how we respond to something, we can only do that when we have that pause and when we learn to focus and we get control over our mind. Last week we talked about the temple formula, where we've got the three areas, the Holy of Holies, where the ark was kept, and that represents the mind, the values, the morality, which then guides the second part of the building, which was where the three main vessels were kept, representing the three emotions, the three primary emotions. And then the outside, which is how we respond to the outside world, which is where the most activity took place. And that's how the formula of a healthy person is. The mind rules the heart, and the heart then guides how we behave and how we act and how we express ourselves. But as we explained last week, to do that, we need to take control over the mind so that we can stop and actually be present and understand where we are, what's just happened. We can process, we can create a thought pattern that can then influence the way we feel and the way we respond. So that's the first part of what we talked about last week. Then we went on to talk about the stuck mind. Right? That sometimes, even if we focus and even if we think and even if we develop a thought process, our mind is still stuck in the paradigm which we used to. So we talked about using the first of the three tools of intellect, which often is not what's used when we think, to use that tool which we called Chachma, right? So we have three components of understanding. Chachma, Bina, Dat. Naturally, by default, even if we do focus and understand something, we're using Bina, but often we're using Bina without the Chachma. What that means, just to go through it very quickly, is that Chachma is that first creative moment which is in the mind, but it's the door. It's in the mind and the conscious, but it's the door and the window and the opening to the subconscious, where we can dig deeper and we can go into the subconscious and find new ideas, fresh ideas, infinite amount of ways of looking at something, so we can actually change a whole perspective and we can come up with a fresh perspective, a fresh view, a fresh interpretation of what's just happened, so that we can use that then to develop and to influence our hearts, our feelings, our responses, in a much more positive way. That's how we unstick the mind, by using that chachma, using that tool of surrendering almost to something outside of our conscious mind, something outside of ourselves, to be able to delve into the more infinite subconscious mind, where much more happens, that we can use those fresh ideas. However, we did explain that there are two things that live in the subconscious. The ego, which is the animal soul, and the divine spark and the godly soul. And we're just having a discussion before. I want to just clarify something. When I said that the ego is in the subconscious, I don't mean that the ego is only in the subconscious. You'd all know people, I'm sure, that the ego is on every single level of their being. All right? There are people that we come into contact, hopefully, obviously present company excluded, but they are... I hope I'm part of that present company. But nevertheless, there are people who, you know, you have to know them for 5 minutes and you'll see it's all about them, right? The world revolves around them and the ego is present on every single level. What I meant was, when I said the ego is in the subconscious, I mean that even when the ego is not there consciously, even when we think that we're not acting out of ego or out of arrogance or out of self-centeredness or selfishness, we need to be aware that the ego is still there. It's in our subconscious, and it could guide what we do and what we think and how we feel. And therefore, we have to check that out and make sure that what we're doing isn't coming from the ego. So therefore, when we delve into the subconscious, when we use the chokhmah, this power of intellect, which is the conscious mind, but it's creative enough and fresh enough to be able to go into the subconscious, we have to make sure that we are ready to go beyond ourselves, to surrender to something higher than ourselves, a moral compass, a moral code, values. In the Jewish concept, that's surrendering to ideas and teachings that God teaches us, which is objective, it's beyond us, it's outside of the world, outside of us, which that is where our faith lives, and that's where that intense guidance lives, and lives in the godly spark of our subconscious. So when we can delve in and find it there, then we can develop a proper selfless perspective that can change the way we respond to the outside world. Now, as we said last week, all of this is only possible with focused practice. In other words, we need to learn to take control of our mind. We need to learn, first of all, to actually make that decision. And make that decision when we live in a world where we wander so much from thought to thought, all haphazardly, all over the place. It's very difficult, actually, to use this chokhmah, because it's difficult to intensely focus, to delve into the subconscious, to find fresh ideas or creative ideas or do a new perspectives or new paradigms. So all that comes from, as I said last week, that mindfulness training, that focus, that ability to stop and focus, and that's something we need to practice. And we need to practice that every day, for part of the day. We can practice it any time of the day. We can practice it when we take a shower, to be actually mindful and focused on what we're doing, and not have all the things that are happening during the day come with us, but just be focused on what we're doing. We can practice it through breathing exercises. We can practice through whatever we do during the day to set aside time to learn how to focus and to remove distractions so that we gain control of our mind. Okay, so that's more or less what we did last week. Now, our brain or our thinking process, we know as three components, as we said before. Chokhmah, which is the conception, the new idea, but also Bina and Daat. And today I want to talk more about Bina. Hopefully we'll get to Daat. If not, we'll do it next week. So let's just develop this a little bit. Now, I'm going to bring a sort of a practical story in a moment, a practical example of how this all plays out, but just to talk about the theory for a moment. So when we talk about the difference between Chokhmah and Bina, and we've done this before a little bit, but just from a different angle. When we talk about Chokhmah and Bina, Chokhmah is when the mind lets in new ideas. Okay, just if we could put it in one sentence. When the mind lets in new ideas. Bina is when our mind processes those new ideas. All right, we clear that? What does that mean? So Bina is when we actually develop a wholesome thought pattern so we can challenge the way we think and the way we interpret. Chokhmah is when we let in the possibility, the suggestion, the creative kernel of maybe we can look at this differently, and Bina is how we process it to actually look at it differently. Right? There's an author and a doctor called, I'm not sure exactly how to pronounce this, but Deepak Chopra or something. I've never come across his work, but sorry? How do you pronounce it? Oh, okay, so I pronounced it right. So he says the following. He says that we have about, I don't know this, we'd have about 100 thoughts, no sorry, 100,000 thoughts a day. Did you know that? Right? Because our mind is always thinking, right? You can't stop thinking. However, he says that about 95% of these thoughts are repeated every day. Right? So in other words, our mind pattern is actually quite inflexible and quite boring, for that matter. Right? By default. Which means we keep playing over the same thoughts again and again. We keep playing over the same record again and again. Which means that's when we keep responding again and again in the same way. Stimulus happens, we respond either without thinking or with thinking, but the thinking that we do is the same thinking we always do. So the interpretation is the same interpretation that we always use. And therefore we don't bring in creative ideas, we don't bring in new perspectives. So that's where Chochmah and Binah come into play if we use them properly. To use Rabbi Wolf's, as I was saying, I was quoting from his book a little bit, to use his words. So to take Binah means to take the creative spark of reinterpretation. The reinterpretation is Chochmah, but the spark, and redirect it into a new way of thinking. Right? So we have a spark, a new spark, we have to redirect it to create a whole new pattern of thinking. Or as he says, Chochmah, it's a nice analogy. Chochmah fished for that thought, and Binah cooks the fish. Right? So let's understand what that means. The word Binah, incidentally, actually comes from the same word as binyan, to build. Right? So it's like taking a foundation that we've created, the foundation being Chochmah, and building a building, a thought pattern, an intellectual edifice, right? Now, just to understand this a little bit, we're going to just revisit something for a few moments, which we've talked about before, and just to understand that Chochmah and Binah is also the marriage between the masculine energy and the feminine energy. Right? That doesn't mean that men don't have Binah or women don't have Chochmah. That's not true because we both have both. But we do find that if we talk about the masculine energy or the feminine energy, that Chochmah and Binah is very much like that. Why? Because as we've explained previously, the male energy, the masculine energy, is the creation of sparks of newness. Right? Just like it plays out in the physical world, in the world of reproduction, the endless, infinite sparks of potential come from the male. And those infinite sparks of potential are unbelievably powerful because they have potential to create, they have potential to produce something completely new, but they also dissipate very quickly. They're an amazing innovation, an amazing potential, but can very, very quickly disappear if not processed, if not nurtured. The feminine energy is to take that spark of newness and to develop it, to nurture it, to process it, as it is in the physical. The female receives the sperm, develops it for 9 months, and then you can produce a baby. Right? So that's how it works in the spiritual as well, and intellectual. The whole energy works like that. I think I've told you this before. That's why men can never find anything in the fridge. You know why? Because they can never stay with something. Open up the fridge, didn't see it the first second, it's not there. That's true. That's why. Right? They walk into a shop, it's either there right away or it's not there, the next shop. That's it. Leave. There's no looking and trying and maybe it's behind, maybe it's somewhere else, maybe it's this, right? I mean, I'm generalizing, but that's the way it is. Okay, the psychologist says I'm not. That's good. Fine. That's excellent. Oh, I'm sorry, like that. I never find anything anywhere. My wife screams at me all the time. No, I'm screaming. I mean, she points it out nicely. All right. Gotta be careful these days. Everything's recorded, you know. It's live. Who knows where it's going? Okay. So that's the way it works, right? So the same thing in the intellectual thinking. We might have a thought, a fleeting thought. We might be ready, you know, maybe I can do this differently. Maybe I can interpret this differently and we act like a splash, a spark. Or maybe there's a different way to do this and it's very possible it can just very, very quickly disappear. But if we have the Binah tool, which is the feminine part of it, it can take that spark, that spark of creativity, that spark of newness, that spark of reinterpretation, and can run with it, can develop it, can make a broad intellectual edifice out of it, and actually come up with a whole new idea. And then that, if it comes up with a whole new idea, then it's a new idea and it's a new concept. It's a challenge to our normal, boring interpretation that we do every single day, and it can bring completely different results, because that's what can happen in that pause between the stimulus and response, and therefore the response will be completely different. We okay so far? Yeah? We're good? Okay. Well, yeah?
I'm not sure about women not being creative, that men have to develop the thoughts first.
Yeah, no. I'm not saying it's not a men and women thing. It's a because both men and women both have masculine and feminine energy, and depends what you use.
Oh, no.
Right? It's the male energy, the feminine, and the female energy. Some of it, like not being able to find anything in the fridge, comes out sometimes in men and women, the nature of men, personality of men and women. Oh, but they're certainly very creative women, and they're certainly very non-creative men. So, right. I mean, you have sometimes, for example, businesses that are run, let's say, only by men, for example, and you have the creative minds and the people who can see things through, right? Which is also a chachma bina thing, really. It's also male and female, but it doesn't. So not necessarily men and women. It's just the masculine energy and the feminine energy. Okay. Now, before we develop this a little bit, I want to just take a story from the Talmud, and see how this plays out. Now, the reason I'm using this story particularly is because it is a famous story, and it's a story which is got to do with the time of year we're in. So next, we just give you a bit of context. Next week we commemorate Tisha B'Av. Next Tuesday is Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av. The day that we commemorate the destruction of both temples, the first temple and the second temple that stood in Jerusalem, I mentioned this last week, plus a bunch of other things that happened on this day, including the spies coming back and saying negative things about the land of Israel. The Spanish Inquisition happened on Tisha B'Av. The First World War broke out on Tisha B'Av. There was the Jews and expulsion from England that happened on Tisha B'Av. Many, lots of tzaras, lots of, it's a day of national tragedy. So it's a day sort of designated to remember these things. But of course, primarily, we talk about the destruction of both temples that both happened on Tisha B'Av. In the second temple, the Talmud tells us that one of the problems that existed that was the cause of the destruction, or the cause of God allowing the destruction of the second temple to take place and allowing the Romans to take us into exile, and which gave rise to a lot of an era and a period of tremendous persecution, was the concept of sinat chinam, which is baseless hatred. And the Talmud goes to tell the following story. It's a famous story called the story of Kamtsa and Bar Kamtsa. I'll read it through with you because I want to play it out a little bit in terms of what we're talking about. So the Talmud says that because of Kamtsa and Bar Kamtsa, Jerusalem was destroyed. What's the story? So let's read it. It happened this way. A certain man had a friend called Kamtsa and an enemy called Bar Kamtsa. He once made a party and said to his servant, go and invite Kamtsa. The guy mixed it up and he went and brought Bar Kamtsa. So when the man, the host, in other words, when the man who gave the party came in and he found Bar Kamtsa there, he said, see, you are my enemy. What are you doing here? Get out. He threw him out. So the guy said, listen, he was a bit embarrassed. He said, since I'm already here, let me stay. And you know what? I'll pay for my portion, right? Like, it won't be on your cheshbon, won't be on your cost. I'll pay for it. So the guy said, absolutely not. So he said, you know what? So let me give you the cost of half the party. Don't throw me out. Don't embarrass me. And the host refused. He said, let me pay for the whole party. And he still refused. And he took him by the hand and he threw him out. Now, part of the big problem at the time was also lack of leadership. And there were rabbis at that party. And Bar Kamtsa said the following. He said, since the rabbis were sitting there and did not stop him, this shows they agreed with him. In other words, they were complicit. I will go and inform against them to the government. He went and said to the emperor, the Jews are rebelling against you. Now the story continues. I'm not going to go into all details. Essentially what happened was, the emperor said, how do you know? And I'll give you a test, the whole thing with the sacrifice. Anyway, eventually he convinced the emperor that the Jews are rebelling. The emperor sent a general. The general came. The general was then replaced. And ultimately, because of that, Jerusalem was destroyed and the temple was destroyed. Now, it's a very difficult story. It's a very painful story. Let's try and work this out. So let's understand what happened here, right? So we have the stimulus. Stimulus is the host comes in and he sees Bar Kamsa. Now that's a reality. No one can change that. He's there. He doesn't like him. That's okay. We're not obligated to like everyone. That obviously had a fallout. They were enemies. Whether that was legitimate or not legitimate is actually not relevant to the story. And there was a response. So there was a stimulus and there was a response. What was the response? The response, there was no pause. The response was instinctive. He comes in. He realizes right away the mistake that his servant has made. Bar Kamsa is sitting there. The response is hatred, rage, revenge. And he throws him out. He humiliates him, embarrasses him. He throws him out. Now, the Talmud is not saying that he should have invited him. He didn't have to invite him. He doesn't like him. He doesn't invite him. He's making a party for his friends. Right? It's not Facebook, you know. It's not like you don't have to have thousands of friends. It's a few friends. It's enough. It's okay to make a private party. It's fine. Right? That's okay. But the problem was that he came and he was embarrassed. And he embarrassed him in public and he threw him out. That was a big issue. So the response was immediate. He comes in, he sees him, there's a response. The response then is emotional. That emotional response then is the, in other words, there was no head. The heart took over, as we've explained. The emotions run very, very quickly. He has an emotional response. That emotional response then guides and leads the way he acts. Ultimately, he takes him by the hand and he throws him out. So what should have happened had there been a pause? Talmud is obviously saying this is a negative story. What should have happened? What would happen if the host was a person who had learnt this stuff and taken it to heart? And he paused and he said, let me think this through before I act, before I explode. Remember, the initial emotional response is not in our control. It's the development of the response that's in our control, right? In other words, when we talk about controlling the heart, we don't mean we never get angry. That's not what we're talking about. What we do, because that's reserved for a few very, very pious people. That can never get angry. We do get angry. People say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing, things happen, we get frustrated. We have the initial feelings of anger. That's a given. What we try and do, when we talk about the head ruling the heart, is we try and keep it under control. We try and guide those emotions. We try not to lose our temper, or to go into rage, or to have a feelings of revenge, or hate, or to nurture that hate, and so on and so forth. So had this person been willing, very difficultly, but being willing to reinterpret or to guide his emotions in a different direction, he would have had, firstly, used the tool of Chochmah. In his head, he was pretty stuck. He heard this guy was a terrible enemy. What's he doing here? He's ruining my party. He needed to use Chochmah. As we'll see, he needed to use Bina as well. But let's start with the Chochmah. So Chochmah would have been a thought, a fleeting moment thought. Let me just see, maybe I'm wrong here, right? Let me dig deeper. Let me try and just come up with a different perspective. Yes, I don't like this guy, but maybe it's wrong to humiliate him. He wasn't thinking about the consequence of humiliating someone in public. He was just thinking about, he doesn't like him. He's an enemy. There was a terrible mistake here. He shouldn't be here. So he needed to start with a different foundation. He needed to start with a different foundation. It's not about me and him and if I like him or I don't like him. It's a whole different story here. It's a different paradigm. And he needs to go into a mode of, there's a person here who I'm about to humiliate. Embarrassing someone in public is a pretty bad thing. Right? Now, even just to get that chokhmah would require tremendous focus. A control we talked about last week, about really being in control of our own mind. Right? I'm using the story purposely because it's a very difficult story. It's like we can all imagine times in our lives where we have similar circumstances where something pushes our button to such an extreme. We don't have a lot of time to think this through. The emotions are running very, very high, and you know we don't always have the emotional response at the same speed. Right? Sometimes it takes 5 minutes for a person to get nervous, but this was right away. He was so enraged with this person right away. Boom, his emotions were flying. So to have control over the mind to say, "One second, let me just stop here. Let me just entertain a foundational thought that will shift me from." Enemy, me, needs to be out of here from to a different paradigm, which is there's a public presence here. I'm about to embarrass someone. Embarrassing someone is wrong. However, if he would have stayed, even if he would have had that chachmah, maybe he did, I don't know, it wouldn't work because that chachmah would have to be translated and processed and nurtured into Bina. Why? Because just imagine if you would have, and we do sometimes, we often are in situations where we do have a second thought. We say, well, maybe this is wrong. And then we just dismiss it and keep going. Why? Because what happens sometimes is we have the Chachmah, but we don't take it into the Bina stage. Because just imagine what would have happened. He would have this thought, but then his emotions would come back at him and he would think, what, am I crazy? In other words, the emotions would be so strong that they would start to challenge that Chachmah spark. And the Chachmah spark, remember, is a potential newness that can dissipate very, very quickly. So he might sort of talk to himself and say things like, am I crazy? What, do you know what this guy did to me? Okay, yeah, it's wrong to humiliate. But him? Okay, so I want to humiliate 99.9% of the population. But him? He's a lowlife. He's a terrible person. He's an enemy of mine. And of course, we have all the post-rationalizations of why he's an enemy and what he did and how terrible it was. Him I can humiliate, right? Or things like thought patterns that go like questions or challenges that come really from the emotional self. Like, why do I have to be the shmata? So I'm going to let him stay here and I'm going to be the rag. I'm going to be the doormat. I'm going to let this guy step all over me and win. He did such and such to me and he's going to sit here by the party, my exclusive party that I've just called and I've just invited the who's who of town to. Right? Or things like, I'm not going to let him sit here in front of all my friends and look like I'm the weak person. So in the name of strength, I'm going to throw him out. All these challenges, right? And all these challenges are very strong challenges. And they will challenge the Chachmah unless the Chachmah is built into a real strong intellectual edifice. Things like, I got to stand up for myself, which by the way is true. It just depends where it's applied. But it's not a wrong concept. Right? And the list goes on. Challenges upon challenges and challenges. When we're in that emotional state, we'll do anything to rationalize it. Even if we had that thought that maybe humiliating someone is the wrong way to go. So that Chachma thought, even if we do have it, for it to be effective, has to translate into a real Bina building. And what is that Bina building? So the mystics tell us that the Bina building is a building that has three dimensions. It's got depth, it's got breadth, and it's got length. What does that mean? In Hebrew it's called Omek, Rochav, and Orech. Depth, breadth, and length. Depth means that as I start to think this through, which is what we should do, whenever we are about to respond, we should always give ourselves time to think it through. And think it through not just to access a Chochmah spark, but to translate into a Bina stage. Depth means that as we start to think it through, we ensure that it's connected to the depth of our soul, the depth of Chochmah. See, often what happens is we might have a spark of morality, a spark of a different, fresh paradigm coming from a strong sense of value. But as we start to think it through, we drift. And the building shifts off the foundations. And when a building shifts off the foundations, it falls down. So the depth means that as we build this intellectual building, it remains connected and rooted in the initial Chochmah thought. Does that make sense? Yeah. That's depth. What's breadth? Breadth means we need to take the idea that we started with and give it breadth. Give it a strong building. Give it a strong space. Right? We need to compare it. We need to develop it. We need to give it layers. We need to give it ideas. So let's go back to our story and see how this would work out. So we need to think, yes, so if he would apply Bina, if this guy, this host, would have applied the concept of Bina, he would have had a thought process coming from the morality of not embarrassing someone, but yet challenged by his emotions of being confronted by an enemy. He would say things like, yes, it's true, he's done terrible things to me. But let me think that through, does that warrant revenge? In other words, is revenge or humiliating him, I need to look at the bigger picture. I need to look at a picture, is it good for me? Am I better off by throwing him out? Yes, he's done terrible things to me, he's an enemy, he's whatever. But am I a stronger person by throwing him out? You need to challenge our own thinking. Why am I challenging my thinking? Because I'm starting from a point of chachma. I'm starting from a point of value. I want to try and look at this differently. Because I know it's wrong to humiliate someone and to compromise someone's dignity, but I need to give it some breadth so that it can affect me. So I need to think, maybe, and this is true for all of us in all different situations, it doesn't matter how big or small it is. I'm just giving an example. Right? Giving it breath means looking at a bigger picture. Looking at the mission of becoming a better human being. Will this make me a human being? Will this make me a better human being? And then there's another concept about looking at why I'm so threatened by this. You know, often we get very threatened by certain situations or by certain people, and we need to examine ourselves in the binah process of why am I so threatened? Now, I'm going to stop there. I'm going to pause, not that kind of pause, but digress for a moment, I should say, right? And share with you a concept which I think I shared a number of years ago, but it's a beautiful idea. It's what I call the grasshopper syndrome. And it's got specifically to do with the story. There's a concept in the Torah called the grasshopper syndrome, but I'll tell you why it's so related to this. Because in the story of the spies, which is also related to Tisha B'Av, as I said, when the spies came back and they gave a negative report about the land of Israel, they said, there's a verse that they said, that when we got there, it's an overwhelming population, and it's impossible to conquer. And we saw giants there. That's what they said. We saw giants. We saw giants so big that we were in their eyes like grasshoppers. In other words, they said that they looked at us like insects. They were big human beings, and they would have looked at us, seen us. They would have seen us. They would have looked. We would have been to them like a grasshopper. That's what they said. Chagavim in classical Hebrew. Right? But if you look carefully at the verse, no, it's not exactly what they said. They said a double expression. They turned to Moses and the Jewish people and they said that when we went into the land of Israel, we saw these huge giants and we felt like grasshoppers to them, and we were to them like grasshoppers. Which the commentaries explain, that gives away the whole secret. They weren't looked like as grasshoppers, but they only were because that's the way we felt. I felt that I was like a grasshopper to him, and therefore I was sure that he was looking at me like a grasshopper. In other words, it had to do not about how big the giants were, it had to do how small they thought they were. They lacked that conviction, they lacked that confidence, they lacked that pride, they lacked that faith. They got scared, they got weak, and therefore they looked at themselves as grasshoppers, which is why they were convinced that they were being looked at as grasshoppers. Now, I'll tell you a fascinating thing, why I'm connecting it to this story. Because the commentaries say the following. I don't know if you ever saw in a chumash, if you were in shul on Shabbat following the weekly parsha, almost every single chumash today, you know, some chumashim have this commentary, that commentary, but almost every single chumash has on the side what they call targum. It's an Aramaic translation of the chumash, the Torah, right? Today it's just there spiritually and symbolically. It's not actually used. In ancient times it was used. In ancient times there was a practice when Jews were under the Romans and Aramaic was the spoken language. Incidentally, it's still a spoken language. You know that? There's still a whole group of people that speak Aramaic. I once sat next to a woman on the plane that spoke Aramaic. They come from, what are they called? I've forgotten. Assyrians. There's an Assyrian community. In fact, in the city there's quite a big Assyrian community. Very, very fascinating group. This is a whole other subject. But I once sat next to one on the plane, a woman on the plane, and she told me she speaks Aramaic, and I studied the Talmud, so I know a bit of Aramaic. And it was fascinating to hear some of the words, and yeah, they were exactly the same. I mean, obviously the Aramaic I study is classic, is ancient Aramaic, and she spoke a modern Aramaic, but it was very, very fascinating. So we were exchanging words, and I was trying to see, it was the first time I realized it's actually a spoken language. But in times where Jews were under Roman rule, on Shabbat, when many of them actually were literate in Hebrew, and they only spoke Aramaic. So on Shabbat, when they would read the Torah, there was a translator. And when they would read a few verses, they would stop and someone would say the verses in Aramaic. But this particular translation of Aramaic is very significant because it was written by a very, very pious person called Unculus. Unculus actually was a Roman who converted to Judaism. He was a great tzaddik. And he wrote this Targum, translation of the Chumash called Targum Unculus, and that's why it's still printed in every Chumash. And it's it's considered a holy translation. In other words, it predates Sansino and Archcroll and everything else, and it's considered a translation with a bit of divine inspiration. Why am I telling you all of this? Because if you look at the verse where it talks about the spies complaining that they felt like grasshoppers, the Aramaic translation of grasshoppers is kmatzim, the same word as kamtsa and bar kamtsa. Yeah. Why? Because so often emotional responses in relationship issues have very little to do with the issue and much to do with how we view ourselves. And that story is a typical example of that. Right? What was bothering him so much? If this guy would have remained in the party, I'm not saying you had to invite him, he didn't, but if he's there and he feels very embarrassed to leave, and it's in front of a whole crowd. So what is it, if this person would have gone through the process of Bina and really examined it based not on ego, but based on the spark, based on the Chochmah, which is access, the selflessness of the soul, he would have examined and challenged his thinking and asked himself the following question: what will it do to me if I let this person stay quietly in the corner and eat his meal? It won't even cost me a dime. He's going to pay for the party. In fact, he's offered to pay for half the expenses of the whole banquet. Right? He could have gained. He could have made a few dollars. So what was bothering him? It's the ego. But what is the ego? Ego is a sense of weakness, not a sense of strength, as we know. Arrogance is an expression of insecurity. It's a person who's insecure, who feels the need to protect their own little fragile self, which different people protect in different ways, but many people protect it through the concept of arrogance, where they need to just bulldoze everyone else that stands in the way so that their fragile self is protected. If he would have really challenged himself and examined himself and gone through the Bina process, he would have realized that it's not a weakness to let him stay. It's a strength. It's a weakness to throw him out. It's a physical strength to throw him out, but it's a psychological, emotional weakness. Throwing him out means that I cannot stand my own ground, that I think that I am weak if I let him stand in my ego, in the way of my ego. If I let him win this argument, so to speak, that means I am defined, my identity is an identity of weakness. That's what it means. That's what he was thinking. But if he would examine himself and challenge himself, he realized that it's the opposite. So often, things that we think are weakness are really the ultimate strength. Winning an argument is not a strength. Resolving a conflict is a strength. Compromising often is not a weakness. It depends where it comes from. It can be a weakness. But it's often not a weakness. It's a strength. Giving in doesn't have to be a weakness. It can be an amazing strength. When it comes from a point of morality and values, and in the case of Kamtsa and Bar Kamtsa, and this is what the commentaries say, this is the depth of that sentence in the Talmud, that Jerusalem was destroyed because of Kamtsa and Bar Kamtsa. The truth is that it wasn't destroyed because of Kamtsa. He wasn't even in the picture. He didn't get invited. I mean, he was supposed to be invited. He certainly wasn't at fault that Jerusalem was destroyed, right? It was because of Bar Kamtsa maybe, but nothing to do with Kamtsa. And actually it was the host. Really the reason was the host. It wasn't Kamtsa or Bar Kamtsa, right? It's an interesting thing. So what does the Talmud mean in its introductory statement when it says that the temple was destroyed or Jerusalem was destroyed because of Kamtsa and Bar Kamtsa? It wasn't Kamtsa or Bar Kamtsa. Kamtsa wasn't invited and Bar Kamtsa was just trying to not protect himself from humiliation. It was the host. And really the depth of it was, it's got nothing to do with the people. It's got to do with what was going on. It was the inability to resolve conflict. It was inability to control the emotion. It was inability. The culture of what was going on then was a culture of Kamtsa and Bar Kamtsa. It was a grasshopper culture. It was a culture of insecurity. It was a culture of weakness. It was a culture of people looking at themselves in such a fragile way, with such a weak way, that they had to do everything to protect that little ego that exists within us, or the big ego that is insecure. Yeah.
Rabbi, sorry, I've got a question. If Bar Kamtsa had a greater neshama, was more involved, etc., and handled it differently.
Also. So the truth is, he was trying to protect himself from being humiliated, right?
Yeah.
And the truth is, in a way, he also could have done things differently. So we're not examining his Chochmah and Bina, but the truth is, you're right. The truth is that Okay, so there's a value in the Torah, but we're never supposed to compromise the dignity of someone else. Embarrassing someone else is a terrible thing. But there's also a thing in the Talmud about someone who is embarrassed and doesn't respond. That's considered one of the highest things. Talmud says that if someone is the recipient of embarrassment and doesn't respond, all these transgressions are forgiven. Because it's a very difficult thing to do, but yet it's very great. And where does it come from? The same thing. It comes from understanding that I don't define myself by what the other guy thinks about me. So Barakamsa could have also done the same thing. That's exactly true. He could have done that. That was the problem. The problem, none of them were doing that. And not only those two, but the host wasn't doing it either. The host was also a Kamsa. I think that's why the Talmud is saying that Jerusalem was destroyed because the Kamsa and Barakamsa, not only referring to the people of Kamsa and Barakamsa, but they're talking about the culture of Kamsa and Barakamsa. It's the lack of ability to reveal the real strength, the real identity of who we are, the real I, which is my godly spark, my inner strength, that is not defined, as we've said so many times, by other people. It's not defined by the perspective of other people. It's not defined by what other people think about me. It's who I am inside, who I'm developing as a person, and the type of human being that I'm trying to be and make others to be and the world a better place. And that didn't happen. It didn't happen partly because they weren't prepared to challenge their thinking. Many, many people, their default position is one of insecurity. The default position is one of feeling that they become defined by the perception of others. Their default thinking is that they become defined outside in and not inside out. Right. So that's the concept. So that's one of the things that if he employed the binah, he would have challenged his thinking in that way. But there are many other things. I mean, the other things that he could have thought about. The idea of what we call it Tzelem Elokim, the image of God on which every human being is created. Not only did he define himself incorrectly, but he defined the other person incorrectly. If we define people and ourselves by externalities, then it's very difficult to tolerate someone that hurt me. It's very difficult to tolerate someone that I don't like. But if I look at the internal identity of a person, mine and others, it becomes a lot easier because I look at the other person differently. They might not be my cup of tea. I don't have to go and socialize or go on holiday with them. But I do recognize that they're still created in the image of God and they're still a human being. And therefore to humiliate them and embarrass them is a terrible thing. If he would have gone through the process of Binah, he would have thought about the concept of resentment and how resentment is destructive for a human being. Maybe he had good reason to be angry with Barakamsa, but walking around, as we've talked about again many times, walking around carrying resentment is a destructive thing. It's a bad thing for me. That's why we've talked about before this concept of forgiveness, that forgiveness is something that is not only good for the recipient of forgiveness, but it's good for the person who's giving the forgiveness, which is why there's that forgiveness prayer that people say at night before they go to bed, even though the person who I'm forgiving doesn't even know about it, but it's good for me to let go of resentment and not to be defined and not be consumed and not carry around hate and resentment all along. And if you would have thought about all of this, you would have come to the conclusion that actually the strongest, the most heroic thing you could do is not to throw him out, but to let him stay. But he didn't do that. So that's what Binah is. Binah is, there's a fleeting moment of let's try and do this differently. That's Chochmah. That's a subservience. That's a commitment to surrender to a different shift. But it disappears very quickly unless you're prepared to really give it a lot of thought. And that's really where we need the ability of focusing. Sometimes the lack of binah is not the lack of ability to understand. So ability, I mean, look, obviously a person needs a brain. A person needs the ability to engage in cognition. We need the ability to think things through. And obviously we need a certain level of intelligence to be able to do that. But often it's not because of lack of intelligence that we don't do that. It's lack of ability to focus that we don't do that. It's lack of ability to think a thing through from beginning to end. And to give it breadth, but after we give it depth, which means to think it through from beginning to end and always make sure that it's consistent with the initial commitment to think of it in a different way, to connect it to a value, to a morality, and then making sure the whole intellectual edifice is able to fit in with a foundational thought of Chochmah. And then the mystics talk about giving it length. Length means that we allow our intellectual thinking to extend to the way we behave and the way we respond. That also is a problem. Sometimes we can understand something fully, and yet we just can't let it extend. We can't let it actually influence the way we actually express it. It doesn't actually have that final implementation. So that's the idea. That's what the mystics tell us, that Bina has depth, breadth, and length. Depth, because it starts with a foundational thought of Chochmah. Breadth, the ability to think it through from beginning to end, to challenge our thinking, to bring in ideas, to think of things different, to understand how we define ourselves, how we define other people in this particular case, and so on and so forth. It's breadth about looking at the whole issue of how we view ourselves, that Kamtza concept, that grasshopper syndrome, not to focus on our insecurity, but to build up the inner self in a proper way, not an arrogant way, but to understand our really true worth. When we understand who we really are deep down, we realize that there's plenty of room for everyone. And we look at everyone, we look at ourselves and everyone else different as well. That's a long breath, that's a long, long thing. It takes a lot of practice, it takes a lot of bina, it takes a lot of building. And then there's the length to let it extend and to give it the ability to actually flow into the world of reality, to flow into the world of how we actually make things happen. Just to give it a little bit of another analogy, so they talk about the depths, the spring and the river. That the Chochmah is compared to a small spring. Where does a spring come from? A spring comes from deep under the ground, the depths of the ground. So they talk about the Chochmah being the small spring accessing the subconscious, the depths, right, as we talked about last week. And then the spring flowing into a river. Rivers are often in mysticism a symbol of Bina. It's a long flowing, it flows, it's a lot of water, it gushes. It's a long thing, it's a big building, it's a big intellectual building. And then ultimately what happens is rivers flow into the sea. And Kabbalistically sees the concept of Malchut, sees that body of water where we swim, sees the reality of where we exist. The sea is a symbol of the length, in other words, how it extends to the way we behave and the way we express it. Now, all of that can only happen properly if we use the third component of intellectual thinking, which is Da'at. Da'at, so we have Chochmah and Bina, which is the mother and father of intellectual thinking, father and mother, I should say. And what's Da'at? So Da'at means, people translate it as knowledge, but it doesn't mean knowledge. The word Da'at actually means connection. We've talked about this before. In the Torah, Da'at is used in a very interesting way. The word Da'at is actually used for intimacy. Like very, very on in early on in Genesis, where it talks about Adam and Eve having children, it says, Adam yada et chava. Adam knew Eve, meaning he was intimate with her. Right? So it's absolute bond, absolute connection, intimate connection. And the Kabbalists explain that Da'at has to happen on two levels. First of all, that means the ability to really connect to what we're thinking. You see, the problem is, we've talked about this many times, so I'm just going to do it very briefly. The problem with thinking, the problem with intellectualization, the problem with rationale is that it's something detached. That it's possible to really understand something from beginning to end, and yet it just remains a theory, just remains a concept. That means we start to connect to it. And we connect it on two levels. First of all, just like with children, we need Chochmah and Bina to remain connected. That original creative thought must always run through and always remain connected with the intellectual edifice. We always have to make sure that as we're thinking through something and we're actually creating a whole theory, that every part of that theory is consistent with the seminal thought, it's consistent with the original idea that laid the foundation for this thought. So that's the Da'at that connects the Chochmah and Bina. And then ultimately, if we want what we think to actually really have the length, as we said, really extend to the way we feel, to really influence our response, then we have to make sure that we start connecting to what we think. And this means the ultimate mindfulness. What it means is to take something that we know and to really contemplate it, meditate on it, and to really think it through again and again and again until it becomes us. Because if we don't, it will remain just a theory. And that's the problem, I think, today particularly. We understand things and we're resistant to revisiting it because we know it already. You know, kids in school do this. You start to teach something, oh, we learned that already. Okay, so that's true. I mean, obviously, when you learn something, you want to learn new things and so on and so forth. But if what we learn is just not theory, if what we learn we actually want to influence us, then we need that. That means we need to connect to what we understand. And the only way to do that is intense mindfulness. It's intense focus, intense revising and playing it through in our mind again and again. And it's about if we know we're experiencing a particular emotional weakness or a particular emotional deficit, if we know we're we're prone to engage in a particular negative emotional response, whether it's anger or jealousy or whatever it might be, and we know the ideas and we want to actually change, we want to actually make a dent, we have to take the ideas of Bina and set aside time to actually think about them, internalize them, connect to them until it becomes part of our emotional being, and then it has an influence and an impact on the way we feel. So that's the intellectual foundation of how we set the scene and we set the foundation for healthy emotions. In the coming couple of weeks, we're going to talk about some of the emotions and how that works, and also how mindfulness flows through that as well, and gives us the ability to respond in healthy ways. Just to mention again, of course, and for the next few weeks I'll keep doing this, so I apologize if I'm sounding boring, but it's a revision, right? Thanks again for all those that are booked for the 22nd. If you haven't, please see the office or book online. But we'd love to have everyone there. Thanks.